What I'd like to do here is discuss just a few notions, one by C.S. Lewis in The Problem of Pain, one by Diogenes Allen in his article entitled Natural Evil and the Love of God, and then after that, tell you a little bit about the work of Richard Swinburne on natural evil. So let's look for a second at an idea given by C.S. Lewis. In fact, two ideas by Lewis. One idea in The Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis is the following, a most intriguing idea concerning natural evil, and one that a full discussion would take us astray at this point, but at least I want to bring it up for just a brief discussion. Lewis makes the point that if we imagine a world in which, say, N people are suffering, okay? Say that N people, say 100 people, are suffering a headache in a population of 10,000 people. Okay, 100 people are suffering. 1% of the people have a headache and they're feeling pain because of that. Now, if for some reason suddenly there was 300 people suffering from a headache, the idea is that in some odd sense, the number of people, while the number of people may increase who have a headache, okay, it was 100 people that have a headache, and then there was 300 people that have a headache. There's a sense in which, however, the actual amount of suffering in the world has not increased, okay? If you have one person with a headache, and then you have another person, and they too have a headache, even though you have two people that have a headache, it's not as if you've sort of increased the amount of evil in the world. It's rather that there's two different bodies, and both the bodies are in the same state, namely in a headache pain state. The intensity of suffering, after all, if, let's say, you have a headache and you walk into the room and the room is full of people, all of which have, or each of which have, a headache. It's not as if suddenly the intensity of suffering in the room has now increased in that room. All that's happened is another person has entered who is in the same state, namely feeling head pain. And so in an odd sense, the point that Lewis is making is that it's awfully hard to quantify the amount and intensity of pain in the world. I think there's something to this. As I said, I don't know that we have time here to develop this thought in more detail, and yet I think it's an interesting insight. The idea is that even though many people might be in a pain state, it's not as if learning that another person is in that pain state is somehow something that intensifies my own pain state. It doesn't. And in fact, if I was on a desert island, say, and there was three other people, and all three of them were suffering from some terminal disease as I were, for example, leprosy or something like this, I think I would actually, other things being equal, I think I would actually be more at home, as it were, with the people that were suffering in a similar sort of way. The world would actually be, the world of the island at least, a better sort of place, knowing that my plight was not alone, but that together we could suffer and try to conquer this thing in a locking arm sort of fashion, that we could all suffer it together and somehow find a consonance in that. Another important claim by Lewis deals with animal pain. Lewis sets aside two chapters in The Problem of Pain on animal pain and how to deal with that. And perhaps one of the best insights that Lewis had on animal pain is the following, and something I think we need to keep in mind, even though it's hard to appreciate. It's hard to understand and to really believe this. I believe that in essence, this sort of thing is true. And it's namely this. The amount of pain and the quality of pain that one feels is, after all, in direct proportion to the development of the central nervous system. Humans have an immensely complex brain, spinal cord, nervous system, and so forth, by which they can feel their environment and they can feel their body, whether pleasure or pain, and all the different states that go with it, dizziness and so forth. But we have to remember, I think, that we have a self-conscious ability to reflect on our state of pain. And this, I submit, is the very essence of suffering. Suffering is when you can self-consciously reflect on the state of pain that you are in at some time. However, some of the lower animals do not have self-conscious awareness. While they are conscious, they are not self-conscious. And therefore, when combined with the idea that their central nervous systems are not as advanced as the human central nervous system, the complexity of the brain, and so forth, it seems to me that we have to make a distinction between feeling pain and suffering. And so it could well be that the lower animals, cats and dogs and so forth, can feel pain, no doubt. This is clear from our experience, from our observation. They can no doubt feel pain, but it's quite another thing to say that they suffer, at least to the same degree of self-consciously reflecting on their state of pain as we do. Once again, this is a hard teaching. Not everyone I know will be sympathetic to this idea. And yet, it seems to me that if we reflect on this reality, that the way that a human is put together is much different than the way that a penguin is put together, or a sparrow, or a cat, that in fact there is quite a bit of truth to what Lewis has taught us in this regard. We turn now to discuss Richard Swinburne, for many years professor of philosophy at Oxford University in England. We turn to discuss Swinburne's views on natural evil. We can't discuss all of Swinburne's views, but I think a number of them do stand out and need to be brought up as important. What Swinburne attempts to do in his article, A Theistic Response to the Problem of Evil, first appearing in Reason and Religion, edited by Stuart C. Brown in 1977, what Swinburne attempts to do is to tell a story which is not irrational, by which a good creator God could allow natural evils in this world to exist. Now, as Swinburne tells the story, he first calls to our attention that God needs to allow evils once again because various evils are logically necessary conditions for the occurrence of actions of certain especially noble kinds. Okay, so when we talk about courage, patience, tolerance, and so forth, there has to be evils by which people are spurred, possibly, to act in courageous, tolerant, and patient ways. Okay, so that's a starting spot, that evil is actually not just helpful if it's there, but in fact logically necessary to attain those things. So whether those evils are moral evils or natural evils, clearly either way, and thus both ways, will help to attain the virtuous character that God has as one of his ends for human individuals. Now, the question that comes up for Swinburne is how much of the moral character, how much of the human character, should God create ready-made when he makes the world with man within it? the way that he deals with this particular issue is merely to remember that it's a much greater thing, that the world should contain free-willed beings who freely come to have a good moral character, rather than that character being ready-made, built in from the beginning by the divine hand. But another way in which he gets to that point is to ask which one of these three kind of worlds would the good God of biblical theism tend to create. Now suppose, looking at three different types of worlds, suppose that the Creator, who is going to create humanly free agents and place them in a universe, has a choice of the kind of universe to create. And suppose that there's these three different kinds. First of all, God could create a finished universe in which nothing needs improving. In such a place, human free agents would know what is right, and they would pursue that end, the good ends of what is right, and they would achieve their purposes without hindrance. In a second kind of universe, Swinburne attests, God can create a basically evil universe in which everything needs improving and nothing can be improved. But thirdly, God could create a basically good universe, but one which is half finished, one in which many things need improving, humanly free agents do not altogether know what is right, and their purposes are often frustrated. However, this third type of world would be one in which agents can come to know what is right and can overcome the obstacles provided in that third type of world's environment to the achievement of their purposes. In such a universe, the bodies of creatures may work imperfectly and last only a short time. As well, creatures may be morally ill-educated, and set their affections on things and persons which are taken from them. Swinburne argues, however, that this third kind of world, a half-finished or half-created world, is the very sort of world that a good creator would want to make if his end was for his human finite creatures in that world to come to have freely the moral character set upon doing the right and the good. Now, such a universe as this third type, the half-created but good universe, might be such that it would require long generations of cooperative effort working together between the different creatures that God made within it to make that world full or finished or perfect. Swinburne, of course, realizes that the first world is a very good world. It's completely finished. It's a world in which humans come into the world knowing what's right, and they pursue it, and they achieve their purposes without hindrance. However, while that first world would not be a bad sort of world, it certainly flies in the face of the divine end of soul maturation. Think of Genesis 1, in which God tells man to subdue the earth. Such a picture shows God as a creator, creating a universe of this third kind. And fairly evidently, Swinburne says, given that men are humanly free agents, our universe is of this kind. And so he first establishes that the universe is of this third kind. It's a good universe overall. However, it's only half finished, and it's given to us the task of finishing the creation, perfecting it, bringing it to be subdued to the goodwill of man. Now, once again, a creator in this situation who decides to create a half-finished universe of this third kind that Swinburne just has described for us, the creator now has to decide the exact way in which he will mold humanly free agents that the world contains. He has to give them a nature of some kind, just as in our discussion earlier, there has to be certain laws that God imposes on the world, decided ahead of time, decided before the first creation moment. And so God has to decide the sort of nature, the sort of character that he'll give to human individuals. Well, certainly, if he wants human individuals to come to maturity, he must make them to be, in some ways, not perfectly mature. They have to have ways in which they can, in fact, mature. As we know in this world, we mature physically, spiritually, morally, emotionally, psychologically, and in all these ways, we mature and go on through growth stages through to, hopefully, full maturity. What Swinburne points out at this point, once again, as I've made it a point throughout our course, is that pain does a very good job of getting our attention. But the thing about pain that's very, very useful to the divine creator is that, one, it gets our attention and keeps it, but two, it does not necessarily, it does not impose a moral character. And so God can create us in an environment of pleasure and pain without imposing a moral character upon us, so that we can freely come to that moral character, and with the guarantee, really, that he will use evils as spurs within our environment to spur us on to mutual and cooperative work together, to overcoming obstacles, surmounting difficulties, and so forth. And thus we see again the instrumental value of evils. Evils get our attention and keep them, but as well, they do not impose a moral character upon us. However, they give us reasons to act in a way that's wise and irrational. Okay, so, for example, let's say 1 week on a particular day, my tooth begins to hurt terribly. Now, it could be that God could build into the world, as it were, that the world operated according to threats and promises in this sort of way, that God would whisper in our ears something like, unless you go to the dentist, you are going to suffer terribly. Or perhaps something more benevolent like this. Someone could whisper in my ear when my tooth begins to hurt, if you go to the dentist, you're going to feel wonderful. Now, God could have built the world in that way, and we remember Hume's second criticism, that it could be world, that the world could have built within it by the divine creator a sort of divine volition that would kick in whenever things like that needed to be done, that I, as a human, needed to be reassured by the divine being to take care of my tooth and so forth. But the pain in my tooth already tells me that something needs to be done with my body at that point. And the pain system in my body is set up so well that I'm able to pinpoint the very problematic point. And what God does provide for us is not threats and promises, nor whispering in our ears, but rather provides inductive evidence. In the past, when someone's tooth hurt, and they examine that tooth, the tooth was found to be different than those around it. Namely, there was something impinging upon the nerve underneath the tooth, or there was decay in the tooth that caused the pain, and so forth. Therefore, in my particular case, I can be well nigh assured that if there is pain, then there is decay or something impinging upon the nerve, which is causing the pain. And so God will use inductive evidence and leave it up to us, using the brains and reasoning power that he's given us, to see and to know that certain causes most probably will follow in certain with certain effects. For example, that an unattended cut or sore will lead to pain later on, that eating and drinking will lead to pleasure, and so forth. Men, of course, don't always respond to inductive evidence. We know, for example, statistics about eating high fat quantities in one's diet and developing cancer later on, or the correlation between smoking and lung cancer. And so people don't always take note of inductive evidence, and they don't always obey it, as it were. God could have made men so that they naturally take more account of inductive evidence, that they naturally obey what they learn from the statistics. They see a correlation between smoking and lung cancer, and therefore they would quit smoking in such a world. But once again, to do so, if God created us in that way, that would be to impose a character upon us. And so, God would not do that. Rather, he gives us the reason and the freedom to deal with the inductive evidence in the world that we can find on our own. And of course, it's worthwhile in this context, again, to point out the importance of a world of regularity. Only in a world which exhibits regularity, that acts for the very most part according to natural laws, moral laws, and so forth, only in such a world will humans be able to finish creating that world. Only in such a world will humans be able to learn to be responsible for goods and evils that they bring about. Only in such a world will human individuals be able to conduct science, learn more about their environment, to finish creating that world. And so again, we have a very strong reason for the regularity of nature. People need not to have a moral character imposed upon them at creation, but they do need to know and be able to use inductive evidence. Once again, if my tooth is hurting, I can be assured that there's something wrong with the tooth causing the nerve to fire in an irregular and painful way. And therefore, I can treat that tooth and thus to finish creating it, as it were. That is, to bring it from a less objectively desirable state to a more objectively desirable state of no pain whatsoever. I would like to drop back just for a second and bring up a point in this article by Swinburne, which deals more with moral evil, but I think it's just an excellent point that Swinburne brings to our attention. It's a point that we know about, no doubt, but to think of it and apply it to theodicy is indeed quite ingenious. And the point really also meshes with a point by Yandell we brought up earlier. Let me see if I can explain this. Swinburne's point is that God, as our creator, has fashioned us and has created us. That is, we are dependent upon God. God is responsible for bringing us into existence. But in a lesser analogous sense, our parents are responsible for bringing us into existence. And it's also the case that our parents have rights to allow their own children to suffer, even to a greater extent than, other things being equal, an adult and a child who are not blood related. A child in that situation, a situation of harm, let's say, a passerby might have different sort, and no doubt does have different sorts of duties to the child who might be in harm. Okay, so in other words, my parents might allow my older brother to treat me in a certain way, say, even to hurt me. In this instance, my parents would be allowing my older brother to hurt me because it allows me an opportunity to learn to fend for myself, to deal business, as it were, with others around me, to learn the limits of the treatment of others, and so forth. All of these are very important relationship development things that I need to learn. Even how to be hurt by those who are stronger than me and to work through those sorts of situations. Those are all important things. However, in a school situation, say, in which a parent is not, or I'm sorry, a teacher is not my parent and not intimately bloodline connected to me, the parent cannot allow the older, I'm sorry, the teacher cannot allow the older child to simply beat up on the younger child. In that situation, the parent has a closer relationship with the kids. The teacher must intervene so that the older cannot take advantage of the younger child. However, my mom or dad could allow such a thing to transpire so that I might learn how to deal with older children, with my own siblings, sharing, and all the different things that cause rivalries among siblings. So the idea is that the connection of parenthood actually allows a parent to allow the child to suffer somewhat greater for the good of the younger and the older brother's soul. But even strong, in an even stronger sense, if this is correct, then God, who is, by hypothesis, so much more the author of our being than are our parents, God has so many more rights in this respect, so that God has rights to allow others to suffer, while I do not have those rights and hence have a duty to interfere instead. And so I believe we can rebut the idea that if human X has a duty to interfere in a situation, then certainly God should have a duty to fear in that situation. But then remember Yandel. Just as God has different means and different ends, so he has a different connection as parent to us. And so he can allow human beings to harm each other in ways that we ought not to allow them to harm each other. This is a very important point in our theodicy. This is the end of 13.